Good afternoon. I'm Don Langvoort, professor of law at Georgetown University and host of the Fireside Chats of the Securities and Exchange Commission Historical Society. Securities and Exchange Commission Historical Society is a nonprofit organization separate from and independent of the SEC. Society preserves and shares the history and historic records of the SEC and of the securities industry through its virtual museum at www.sechistorical.org. Today's chat will be preserved in the museum, so you can listen to the discussion or read the transcript later. Today's fireside chat looks at state securities regulation. Our guest is Christine Bruin, securities administrator for the state of Maine and immediate past president of the North American Securities Administrators Association. The remarks made today are solely our own and are not representative of the society. Our speaker cannot give investment or legal advice. I'd like to thank the North American Securities Administrators Association for sponsoring today's fireside chat. Chris, we're going to talk today about what's known as blue sky law or state securities regulation. It's a body of law that I suspect not all of our listeners are familiar with. The first comprehensive state security statute was found in Kansas in 1911. 20 years before we had federal securities regulation, so it's the long-standing system of securities regulation in the United States. Once nearly all states had securities regulation, the natural question came, how are states going to coordinate their activities so that there's not conflict or overlap or difficulties? Congress in the 1930s faced up to this issue when it put into place a system of federal securities law. But Congress very carefully chose not to preempt state securities regulation and instead encourage its development and encourage a system of what was then called cooperative federalism. So I guess the first question I want to ask you is, now that we're 60 or 70 years after the federal securities laws and coming up on 100 years since the first comprehensive state law, what's happened? What kinds of steps have been taken at the state level to reduce the problem of conflict and overlap? There's got to be a long history there.
There is a long history, and I think it would take more than the hour we have here to really go into any detail. But I think the thing that sort of sums it up is sort of the evolution of the Uniform Securities Act and this idea that we would try to the extent possible, while allowing individual states to exercise sovereign power, to have a uniform way of doing business. And the Uniform Securities Act in 1956 and then the revised Uniform Securities Act in 75 all tried to evolve that process right up to a more modern evolution of.
So it was in 1956, finally, we got some attempt to coordinate what the laws look like in the various states, and,
right.
And most states
yep.
have adopted something based on either the original Uniform Securities Act or the more modern revisions we've seen in the last decade or so. Describe for me, in general, how a blue sky law statute looks. Let's take Maine, which is your state. What power does it give you as a securities administrator?
The Uniform Act gives us a few different general pieces of authority. One, it allows us to review all of the securities offerings that are going to be sold in our state. Now, we've been preempted, and we'll talk about that probably later, but the idea is that before a security can be sold in Maine or in any other state, it needs to be reviewed by the securities regulator or have some sort of an exemption. It allows us to review and make a determination about what firms or professionals are going to be allowed to do business in our state.
So a brokerage firm or an investment advisor has to deal with you as well as with the SEC and the NASD.
That's right. It's sort of like having a license to practice law or be a doctor. It's a professional license and is controlled at the state level. It allows us to do on-site exams of broker-dealers and investment advisors and use the information that we find in those exams to monitor what's going on in our states. And then it has a broad range of enforcement authority, everything from administrative to civil to criminal, investigative and a prosecutorial authority.
And we're going to talk a lot today about the enforcement and the prosecutorial authority that the states have. But let's talk for a minute about registration, because I suspect many lawyers and people familiar with securities law would say, that's the real heart of blue sky law. If you want to make an offering of securities, deal not only with the SEC, but the various states in which you want to sell your securities. And you mentioned federal preemption. There's a story there. For a long time, states had very broad authority with respect to all different kinds of offerings.
And I'd just like to comment on the term blue sky law. As state regulators, we never use that term.
Why is that?
It's a term that the bar uses a lot to describe the process or the rules that they research and have to follow in order to make a securities offering in a state. And while the term has a lot of good historical meaning, we don't use it at all to describe our current law because it's so much broader than how to register a security. But I think you were asking about registration. Before NISMIA, which is the first big chunk of preemption,
Which occurred in 1996.
1996, that's right. National Securities Markets Improvement Act, in case anybody doesn't know the acronym. Before that time, every security that got sold in our states had to be cleared by us or qualify for an exemption that occurred under state law. After NISMIA, the Congress basically took away the authority for us to make any determination about a large body of securities. The biggest would be the mutual funds. Before NISMIA, yes, most New York Stock Exchange securities, for instance, did not have to be registered in a state, but that was by virtue of state law. After NISMIA, that sort of incorporated those exemptions into federal preemption, but that didn't really impact us as much as not being able to review those mutual fund filings and make a determination about whether they could be sold in our state.
Mm-hmm. And one of the philosophies that Congress articulated in 1996 was the sense that the state should focus their regulatory resources on smaller offerings as opposed to the big ones. And that's a line largely respected, but there are some curiosities in NISMIA. For example, some kinds of very small private offerings get preempted as well.
That's right, and I think that's one of the ones that gets under the skin a little bit of state regulators. I think you have to look at those offerings almost on an individual offering level, and we used to spend a lot of time looking at who were the folks that put those offerings together, what experience did they have, what kind of money were they going to collect, how were they going to use that money, what kind of fees were they taking. And I think that's a place where we added a lot of value to making sure that before our citizens were exposed to an offering, it had passed certain minimum levels. And I think, in my view, that's one of the ways that NISMIA went too far in making that purely a notice filing in our states and taking away the ability to look at those more closely.
Which provides us with a natural bridge to what we're going to talk about for most of the rest of the hour, which is enforcement, because what NISMIA is saying really is don't regulate these kinds of offerings up front, rather wait for something bad to happen and then step in. And I guess it's the bad things that happen that that you all have to focus on today. Before we go to that, I want to ask one more question, because this fireside chat is sponsored by NASA. Explain what NASA is and when it came about.
NASA, the North American Securities Administrators Association, is the oldest international organization of securities regulators. It was organized in 1919, and it's a way for the securities regulators in both the United States and the Canadian provinces to get together and share information about issues that are coming up in our regulatory areas, to collaborate on enforcement initiatives or exam initiatives, to comment as a group on trends that we see going on in the industry. It gives us a mouthpiece to the SEC and the SROs in terms of their rulemaking or their initiatives that they might be taking.
So if NASA has been around since 1919, with a very distinguished existence, does that mean that there has been a very coordinated system of state securities regulation since 1919 in terms of enforcement and inspection and all of those other things? Or is it a more recent story that NASA has come forward and really made it so that multi-state securities enforcement works?
I think it's the more recent story. We talked about the Uniform Securities Act. I think a lot of the collaboration amongst state securities regulators was looser before the 80s, and a couple of reasons for that. We didn't have the types of technology that we have today. I think we've already started to take for granted things like email and conference calls. To do a collaborative effort pre-80s, you had to have an in-person meeting or rely on the U.S. Postal Service, the snail mail, and that just made broader coordination not as practical and efficient. During the 80s, we started to see a couple things happening. One, the Central Registration Depository, fondly known as the CRD, was a collaborative effort between the NASD and NASA to provide for one-stop shopping for licensing, which before 1984, if you were a broker in New York and you wanted to be licensed in all the 50 states, you had to send a piece of paper with your picture and a form and a fee to each of those states. After 1984, you could file this one form with the CRD system, and it would go electronically to every state. And it started that automating of licensing, which in 2004, we take a lot of online licensing and processing for granted. I know I can renew my driver's license now on the internet, but in 1984, this was just unheard of. And from a regulator's perspective, it allowed us for the first time to have an index of every person who was acting as a broker, every broker-dealer, and where they were, and we gradually added information there about branches and who the managers were and information about whether they'd had complaints or arbitrations or regulatory actions against them. So it provided this vast amount of information that allowed regulators to be able to really get good information about the regulated industry. The other thing it did was, in order to get on the system, we started instituting these minimum competency exams, and NASA developed the Series 63, which is the state law exam, which we own, and it provided funding for NASA, meaningful funding for NASA for the very first time.
So in other words, if a broker, registered rep, or financial advisor wants to be qualified to work in an office in Maine, he or she has to take the nationwide test.
Generally, what happens is a broker would take that Series 63. Part of that funding would come to NASA. Before this exam, each state oftentimes had its own exam. So this is a good way to bring efficiency. It brings more uniformity to the process. And at the same time, it allowed us, for the first time, us being NASA, to have enforcement conferences or send teams of brokers like we did in the 80s out to Denver, Colorado, and something we called the Denver Project, to go and examine a couple dozen penny stock firms. It allowed us to leverage the knowledge that might be in one state that had a large staff in terms of how to do examinations or how to do enforcement actions. As a young lawyer in Maine in the 80s, I learned how to examine broker-dealers by going to penny stock firms in Denver and watching folks from Connecticut and California and Florida who had a lot more experience do that and participate in that. And then I was able to come back to Maine, and I'm sure I'm not an exception, and start an exam program in a small state where we might not have had one. So it was a way to have all the boats float, or whatever that expression is.
So, and maybe it's worth tying all this together, because we've thrown out a whole bunch of ideas here. In the 80s, we have the Central Depository that is going to allow you in Maine to see that somebody who was a bad guy in your state seems to have set up shop in Massachusetts. You could talk to the Massachusetts regulators. There was now a basis for sharing information and ideas.
And can I add a point to that,
Absolutely.
Don? I think it was also a necessity, because the industry started to use the telephone, and the telemarketing concept really took off in the 80s, so that you could be sitting in Maine or Utah or California, and the broker who was calling you and offering you a stock was sitting in Denver or Salt Lake City or Florida. They weren't respecting state boundaries. So
right.
One of my predecessors said, you know, securities regulation in Maine is not like regulating barbers. There's no relationship between the need for resources and the number of heads that need their haircut in the state. We have folks from all over the country trying to sell to Maine investors. And so as state regulators, we needed to get a better handle on what was going on everywhere, not just in our own jurisdiction.
And you use the phrase penny stocks in Denver and Salt Lake City.
Yes.
That's not happenstance either. There's a long history to things, matters states have particularly been interested in with respect to the kinds of scams and boiler room operations that fly often under the national radar screen, set up locally, exploit people. Explain a little bit about how investors get hurt in those kinds of scams that would lead to something like the Salt Lake project or the Denver project. I mean, what is it we're going after here?
What we saw in the 80s was some pretty outrageous conduct. We would go so far as to call these boiler rooms. A lot of young people recruited without any experience in the brokerage industry, given scripts, and taught how to do a hard sell of securities that were the securities often were being manipulated, the markets were being manipulated, and the brokers had scripts.
And these were tiny, largely unheard of stocks.
Right. They were stocks you'd never heard of before. And one of their selling points was they're a penny stock. You can buy these for 1 cent a share or 5 cents a share. Of course, you had to buy 100,000 shares to, you know, make it meaningful. But some of the scripts we saw in those days would have, you know, you have to make a decision now. This is, you know, we've only got so many shares of this. You have to make, the deal's going to close at the end of the day. We have inside information that it's going to go through the roof by next week. And when people resisted, they had all kinds of responses playing on male egos. My favorite was, you know, who wears the pants in your family? You don't have to check with your wife before you can, you know, make a commitment to buy this security. So they really engaged some outrageous practices. I guess the granddaddy of them all was Blinder Robinson, that started business in 1982 in Denver. And so from there, we see dozens of these Blinder spinoffs starting. And the states in this time period are starting to band together to go to Denver or Salt Lake and do combined exams and see if we couldn't get a handle on who these people were and try to find aspects of state law that we could use to shut them down. Sometimes it was as easy as finding unlicensed broker-dealers or brokers and going at them from that perspective. But just as fast as we'd shut them down, you know, 5 or 10 more would spring up.
So you, as a Maine securities regulator, went to Denver or Salt Lake City to learn about how a coordinated process of inspection and enforcement works. And obviously that process was very important in helping develop communication. You got to know people in this world of state securities regulation, and the lines of communication got opened that hadn't been opened before.
Yeah, I'm glad you put it in those terms, because that's exactly right. It allowed us to meet each other in the other states, and you started to see certain leaders evolving in terms of states that were particularly good at this. But it also was the beginning of some pretty good partnerships and relationships with the NASD and the SEC in terms of sharing information about these penny stockbrokers, and also forming sort of a collaborative spirit, because the actions were so outrageous that it sort of unified all the regulators in their efforts to want to put an end to
Explain
it.
Explain how that happened. How did the SEC, I can understand how NASA sponsored a coordinated effort among the states. Were NASD and SEC people simply invited to sit in and discuss and share ideas? Is that how it happened?
We started having annual enforcement conferences on the NASA side, and we always invited the heads of enforcement at the NASD and the SEC. And it gave rise to some relationships so that people called each other in between times, and also was the ability for regulators to share tips and information about trends that they were seeing, and just try to work a little more closely together.
So the groundwork was laid by these kinds of projects for more cooperation, and what you're really telling is a technology-based story. Once there were ways of communicating and relationships got built, then communication and cooperation happened much more easily than it had in the past.
As state regulators, we always say we're the ones that are closest to the investors, and in a way it gave us the ability to close a loop with the federal regulators using communication so that we could take what they were seeing at on a national market-wide basis with what we were hearing from our local investors and put that information together.
And that's an important point. We're going to come back to this later on, but there is a way in which you sitting in Maine may have a better feel for what's going on in some of these kinds of cases than somebody sitting in Washington would, simply because people can get through to you a little bit more easily than they might to somebody sitting in a big agency.
I think that's one of the great selling points for state securities regulations, really, is that any citizen can pick up the phone and call and get me, and we often have one investor walking in with a bag full of account statements saying, I have a problem here, and we have the ability to try and sort out one investor at a time, their problems. I think the larger regulators have to go on numbers. They have to wait for certain numbers of complaints about a certain topic or a certain dollar amount of losses before they can focus on it. We find that by hearing the collective stories of individual investors, we often hear things faster and can respond faster. And I think you can see that in, even in the early days in looking at the penny stock issues, we were, I think it was, I'm trying to think, in 1989, NASA did a resolution, which is basically a collective pronouncement, saying that blank check blind offering pools were fraudulent practices. And then you see in 1990 Congress actually passing the Penny Stock Reform Act. So I think these issues are being raised and looked at on sort of parallel tracks at that time, with some information going back and forth. Some other examples of that would be, later on when we start looking at limited partnerships and the roll-up problems that we saw, you see that NASA coming out and saying there's a problem here, and then shortly after that, Congress passing some legislation or doing some hearings.
Right, and I think internet securities fraud is another place.
That's right.
We move forward in time where the states, in many ways, got there first.
In 1996, which is jumping forward just a little bit, the state regulators were the first ones to issue interpretive guidance on how you could use the internet to sell your offering without being deemed to sell unregistered securities in our jurisdiction. And shortly thereafter, the SEC issued interpretive guidance at the federal level, which largely followed the model that the states had set a couple of years earlier.
Okay, well, let's wind back in time. And I guess if we're looking for big events in the federal-state relationship or cooperation among the states, we come to a series of major enforcement actions that happened involving some of the nation's biggest brokerage firms. Tell that story and how the states came to be involved in cases like Solomon and Hutton.
Yeah, I think against that backdrop of, having some funding now to do multi-state cases and communication sort of improving, conference calls coming onto the scene, the states started to do collective cases, and at first I would call these sort of piggyback, or sometimes we call them Me Too cases, where, for instance, in the Hutton instance where they had the convictions on check kiting, because those were criminal violations under state law, that could be a disqualifier from being able to do business in a state under the Uniform Securities Act. And so what happened was the states approached Hutton and said, you've got a problem with us too.
And so this is after the SEC had taken the lead on this particular matter.
Yeah,
after the states saw that they had a role to play as well.
After they had resolved that matter, and you'll see it again in the Drexel cases, where there had been some resolution at the federal level without really any communication between the states and the SEC on how that would get resolved, and the states coming forward and saying, well, you've got a problem with us too. And so this is kind of the, I'd say it's the beginning of the collective cases by the states, but largely following on something that the SEC had done.
So the SEC identifies a violation, the states step forward and say, it's something more than a federal securities law violation. If you want to do business in our state,
correct.
Of course, you're not going to be a brokerage firm unless you're qualified to do business in the various states. You have to settle with us too, or face some kind of remedy.
And the firm started to see that if they didn't come to the states as a group, what would happen is one or two states might file actions, and that would be tougher on them than if they sort of initiated some way to resolve it with all the states. In some of those early cases, the firm actually had to go state to state to state and say, you know, I've resolved it with these six states this way. Can I get you to go along with this too? One of the big cases was with Solomon, which was with the Treasury bond cases, and that was unique in that it was resolved also with Solomon contributing to the Investor Protection Trust, which was a nonprofit set up by the state regulators to fund investor education initiatives. And so we started to see the importance of investor education rising because we had some funding to spend on it, and the firms sort of more willing to fund that type of effort than to pay more in a fine.
Now, was there an effort in cases like Solomon and Drexel by the states to improve the process of coordination, or were states by and large happy to be negotiating individually and extracting their bits of remedies?
I think both. I think there was some recognition on the state side that we might do a better job if we coordinated and did it in a uniform way. There was also some pushback at this point from the firms and the law firms they hired, saying this is ridiculous and expensive to have to go one state at a time and negotiate these unique deals for each state. You all basically have the same cause of action, even if it would be in, you know, different jurisdictions. Can you not get together? So you start to see these collective task forces set up, sometimes with some contact with the SEC, sometimes not. I think the first really big one and sort of a watershed case was the Prudential Limited Partnership mm-hmm. case, where the state regulators probably had their finger on the pulse of this sooner, because individual investors were calling and saying, this is what's happened to me. I've been wiped out.
You might explain what the Prudential case was all about and how the investors felt they were.
Yeah, the Prudential was an interesting case in that if you were a state regulator and you got a complaint about someone selling you a limited partnership that said it was just as safe as a CD or was going to return this really strong return on an investment, something that was out of proportion even for the early 90s, you might think you had a rogue broker or a rogue branch office. But as the states looked at this more closely, it led right back up to the top of Prudential, and the way they put together the Prudential Limited Partnerships, they were fraudulent right from the beginning and right all the way through. And it was just because it was Prudential, nobody really believed that or caught on to that. For quite some time.
Explain how that investigation evolved. I mean, were various states independently being visited by investors who were making these complaints? Did NASA put in motion a coordinated effort to do this investigation, or were a lot of people doing the same work at various places around the country?
Well, since we do the enforcement conference once a year, we have the opportunity, even if we're on separate tracks, to bring it together at least one time a year. And I think that's what was happening in the late 80s and about 1990. All of a sudden, states individually were seeing this rise of complaints about Prudential limited partnerships. Then there was an enforcement conference where one person raised the issue, and all of a sudden a lot of hands went up and said, yes, I'm seeing this too. And the NASD and the SEC were at that meeting as well. And there was a determination made to do a sort of loose collaboration. The state's carrying forward on their investigation of the individual investor complaints, and the SEC taking off the piece of investigating the firm and what was going on at the top and amongst the managers. And that was the first time we see a true collaboration in the investigation and settlement. Up until that time, there had been investigations by the SEC we piggybacked on, or investigations by the states, but not resolutions sort of individually. The Prudential case is a big fraud. It's more work than any one regulator can do. There's recognition that we need to try and pull this together. And at the same time, these are like foreign worlds meeting each other. Once they get past the nice conversation about tips and information, all of a sudden you have to kind of try and coordinate, well, who's going to talk to this person, and who's going to make the judgments about what it all means, who's going to make the decisions about how this case should be resolved. And Prudential, I think, formed an opinion that the SEC was going to be easier, that they would allow them, one, that they had a bias in favor of letting them stay in business, whereas a couple of those wild...
Because they were so big?
Because they were the SEC, and because it was Prudential, such a big and, iconic, you know, member of the market, that they weren't going to let the rock go out of business. Whereas there were a couple of wild-eyed state regulators who had interviewed enough investors and said, you know, this is the same kind of stuff we shut down penny stockbrokers over. Why shouldn't we shut down Prudential? It's the same high-pressure marketing, same outrageous promises. It's fraud, same fraud.
Yeah, and I want to go into this a little bit because we have the potential for 50 or so state regulators having different points of view on what the right thing to do with a Prudential is. And it would seem to me there'd be a lot of room for disagreement, and it would be very hard to come to a consensus, even among, forget about the SEC for a minute, mm-hmm. even among the states. How did that process get worked out? I mean, it was ultimately a successful effort. I'm curious to know how the wild-eyed group got reined in so that you could get to an acceptable agreement on this deal.
Well, we formed a task force and appointed administrators from a number of states to be on that, and they represented different groups. Some of them had a lot of complaints, like Arizona and Idaho had already had a lot of complaints. Some of them were sort of the old, they would hate it if I called them the old and wise group, but they were the elder statesmen, the people that everybody looked to and thought had good judgment and good knowledge, folks like Lou Brothers and Don Saxon from Florida and Lou Brothers from Virginia. And that had the effect, I think, of helping the group collectively feel like there was a plan and that there were good people who are both the energetic enforcement, we're going to get them types, and the more measured folks who had the longer perspective, and that they would reach a good arrangement. The other thing that that case was interesting too, unique in that for the first time, the state sent out questionnaires to a very large sampling of Prudential investors to try and sort of quantify in a more scientific way exactly what had been invested and how those investors thought they had been wrong. So that evidence coming together allowed it all came to one place. So it allowed that sort of coordination and collaboration at a more universal level. And I don't want to lead you astray. There were always states on the sidelines, especially as it got towards settlement, who said, I want a little bit more, or I'm a little unique, or there's some reason why, you know, we shouldn't participate in the collective global settlement. But in the end, those things got worked out.
And it was a matter of leadership from this group that pressured the states that might have considered defecting to stay with the program?
Yeah, it was. It was clearly leadership. It seems at the right moment, the right people came forward with the right message and were able to unify the group to come up with one common answer. And as you said, it became more complicated because we were working with the SEC, and they had their own ways of doing things and their own perspectives. And Prudential had this sense that they could settle with the SEC because they were, quote unquote, more reasonable. And they entered settlement negotiations with the SEC and even reached a tentative settlement and sort of presented that to the states as though, okay, this is the settlements. And the state response, even from the measured, more laid-back state administrators, was, forget it. You haven't negotiated with us. We haven't been part of this. And the firm tried to say, well, we always had an empty chair for you at the table, which was, besides being pretty funny, was insulting and rather arrogant. And if anything, it fed the idea that the states needed to reach their own settlement based on their own judgment. And what ended up happening was more collaboration between the SEC and the states in terms of how that ultimate resolution was going to come along. And some of that was frustrating. There was one report from somebody who was there at the time about one of the SEC attorneys calling the states 15 nibbling ducks. And that sort of captures that idea of if you're the SEC, you can't just negotiate with one group that calls itself the states. Even though we work through NASA, we're each sovereign states. And sort of this sense of we're the SEC, who are these people and why do we have to deal with them? And then the state side of it being, we're the ones who've been interviewing these investors. We know how bad the harm is and we're not going to go away until we have a restitution fund that we can live with. And we're willing to yank the ticket, take away the license of Prudential if we have to get there. In that way, the states provided leverage, I think, to the SEC, and we ended up with what, from a securities regulator's perspective, was a great settlement, over $1 billion being paid in restitution to investors.
In fact, what was created was an open-ended restitution fund in which investors could make their claims before an impartial team of arbitrators, evaluators, and whatever the amount came to, Prudential was obligated to pay.
That's right. So no matter how tough it might have been to get all those regulators to resolve and come out on one page, ultimately they did. The states all settled, and investors really came out on top in that one.
So Prudential must have been a big step forward in getting everybody's attention that when there is a big securities fraud, there is a state component to this as well as a federal component. And also, I assume, in solidifying some relationships between the SEC and the NASA people and state regulators. Did the states come away with this more comfortable that they could go to the SEC with future cases and there would be a cooperative relationship?
I think so. The state folks who were on that task force came away from it feeling like they had demonstrated that they were a professional, not amateurish, securities regulators, and that they could be effective in these types of situations. I think that the relationships it established a certain level of trust between the individuals who had been involved. And I think from thereafter we see large cases, it's hard for the firms to settle unless they have both the SEC and the state regulators willing to sign mm-hmm. on.
So we go from Prudential, which is in the early to mid 1990s, through the stock market boom of the late 90s, which I think everyone regards as a time in which securities enforcement was not a big issue.
Funny, aren't any really big cases in that time
right,
period.
Right, because everybody's making money.
Covers all the mistakes.
And yet, at least in retrospect, we start seeing things that are of interest, that what were called penny stocks in the 1980s become microcaps in the 1990s, and the gold mining and uranium firms of the 70s and 80s become dot-coms in the 90s, but surprise of surprise, we hit the crash of 2000, 2001 with the popping of the tech stock bubble, and we come to a new round of enforcement actions where the states come back into the picture. So why
turns
don't we
out
turn?
It, turns out everything wasn't so grand during that time period after all.
Not surprising at all. Well, I guess our next round and what really has focused a lot of people on the presence of state securities regulators began when Eliot Spitzer, the Attorney General of the State of New York, stepped forward with evidence, emails and various things that he said showed that there was a bias in the big investment banking houses as they were doing their investment research work. And Eliot Spitzer said, among other things, the SEC must have been sleeping here because look what I found, but stepped forward insisting on a very aggressive enforcement action against those firms. Before we go any further, I guess it's worth noting for people that New York is one of those states that is not the typical Uniform Securities Act state, but rather the Attorney General in New York works with the Martin Act. How's that different from what you have?
Well, I won't claim to be an expert on the Martin Act, and I'm sure Attorney General Spitzer's probably going to disagree with what I say about it, but I think it's not as strong as the Uniform Securities Act because it's an anti-fraud statute, which the Uniform Securities Act has anti-fraud and this wide range of administrative possibilities, from everything from examination authority to cease and desist authority. There's a lot of different ways to resolve something other than, you know, hitting them over the head. I think why Attorney General Spitzer's been so successful is he has the securities operation in his office, and he's both the person who interprets the laws and prosecutes them. And so he's been able to take an issue, and he was right on target with the research analysts, and so he's done a terrific job of highlighting something that needed to change. But
explain a little bit, so that everyone is aware, the exact nature of the concerns, the complaint against the investment banking firms that the states move forward on.
The cases ended up focusing on the fact that research analysts, the people who were putting out the buy-sell ratings, were being influenced by investment banking. Most of the money in these big brokerage firms was being brought in by investment banking. Again, it's the booming 90s, the dot-coms. We have an IPO a week. You can't even keep up with, you know, who's doing the gavel at the New York Stock Exchange. And the firms were making a lot of money bringing issues forward, and the relationships between those two parts of the business became so intertwined that the research analysts really became part of the marketing effort of the firm to get the next big investment banking piece of business. And it affected the whether they said buy or sell or hold, depending on what kind of business they had gotten from the firms. We saw cases where there was actually outright fraud, where someone issued a rating that they didn't believe in because of investment banking, all the way to the other end of the range where these large firms were allowing their departments to be so overlapped that it allowed the potential for very serious conflicts of interest.
And what became famous in terms of the evidence that was uncovered to support those claims was a series of emails.
Yeah, technology comes around again. Yeah.
Yes, it becomes one of the themes in this whole story. So Eliot Spitzer, and certainly jurisdictionally, being the Attorney General of the state of New York, where the big investment banking firms are located, insists that something be done. And in fact is prepared to take this case. He sort of threw down the gauntlet to the SEC. From the standpoint of another state securities regulator, what was your reaction to how this case got built in terms of, you know, we've just finished talking about Prudential and a series of actions in the late 80s, early 90s, where there seemed to be a very cooperative working relationship that had been built and good personal relationships that have been developed. This seemed to be confrontational. So I guess what I'd like you to do is get into that story a little bit.
I think this case broke the rules as we had come to see them, which was that you have one regulator very publicly saying that another regulator had dropped the ball, been asleep at the switch, whatever phrase you want to use. Our differences with the SEC in the past had been, you know, in rooms by ourselves, from one regulator to another, it was unheard of for somebody to go to the media and say another regulator had failed in some way. So we got off on a bad start here. That's not the way to start a collaborative effort, by going in the Wall Street Journal, and the New York Times, and Washington Post, and saying the SEC failed. So that was a rough beginning. As a state regulator, which Elliot Spitzer is, his agency is a member of NASA, and whether we liked the way he was going about it or not was not as important as the fact that he had found something very important, serious, and there were indications it wasn't just one firm, it wasn't just Merrill Lynch, and it needed to be investigated. And to do that kind of investigation was going to need a collaboration of many states. And so very shortly after the Merrill Lynch case came together, the rest of the states through NASA came on board in terms of forming a task force of state regulators to try and tackle the subject market-wide. And we ended up with 12 different investigations with participation by 45 states. And so you had a lot of Elliott's group took on Solomon Smith Barney and Morgan Stanley, and of course they did Merrill Lynch to begin with. But all those other firms, the rest of them, were investigated, and the efforts were of teams of other state regulators who went out looking for, subpoenaing those emails and going through them to see if there was evidence of these conflicts of interest or fraud.
So you have many, many states actually physically doing the investigations, taking the testimony, looking at the documentary evidence and things like this. What about the SEC? Where was it in this process of investigation?
Well, I don't think you can say, SEC, you were asleep at the switch, and expect them not to have some big reaction. And so their reaction was to put a lot of their resources into doing the same kind of investigations we were doing at that time, going into the top 10, the largest firms, and looking at their email. And we had a very competitive atmosphere there at the beginning in terms of them not wanting to be shown up again, and trying to recapture their preeminent regulator position. And so for a period of months, we had a lot of these parallel investigations going on, with the SEC leading investigations by the New York Stock Exchange, the NASD, and of course the SEC staff on the one hand, and NASA now getting together and taking on the responsibility for these other investigations with participation by New York.
And yet it was a competitive process as opposed to a coordinated one. Was that because of the tone that was set at the beginning? Do you think, had a different tone been set, you would not have had that level of competition?
It was such a unique circumstance, so many firms, such outrageous behavior. I don't know that you wouldn't have had some competition anyway, but certainly the way this got started, the environment, was a pretty big hurdle to overcome in the beginning. There was communication. There were regular phone calls, and I think securities regulators, even when they're competing, can't help sharing some information about, we looked at these kind of frauds, or we figured out how to look at these analysts or this sector, or look for these dirty words in emails, because they're almost always connected with some conversation about their ratings. There was some collaboration going on, but not nearly at the level it should have been, or maybe would have been, if we hadn't started out on the wrong foot together.
I'm curious whether what we see, obviously, is the states taking a much more activist role in the 90s, and certainly in this round, with respect to securities regulation, and that can certainly connect to the standard investor protection purposes that have been behind state securities regulation for a long time. Is there also an element here in which states have come to realize that they have a lot of money at stake in the stock market? State pension funds, state treasurer's office, where, if you have research bias affecting stock prices, it's not only citizens who've been hurt, it's the state itself. Has that affected how state securities regulators see their role?
I don't think so. I think what it's led to is some more activism by other state officials, you know, the treasurers taking a stand on the standards they want applied, the attorney generals looking at Elliott Spitzer and saying, well, you know, is there a role for me too? As a state regulator, our focus has been, is, and will continue to be, you know, what's best for the investor. Most of our group are career lawyers, investigators who have been regulators, care passionately about protecting investors, and will continue to do that as this era fades away and we find other ways of working with the SEC, trying to come up with a framework for the next big case that comes along.
So now to get back to our story with respect to what becomes the global settlement in the research analyst cases, rather than waiting for a global settlement, Attorney General Spitzer moved quickly against Merrill Lynch, was able to negotiate a settlement with them that I think was seen large around the street as a benchmark to which others would have to face, which I suspect created a large amount of anxiety on Wall Street about what it means now to be fighting battles with the states, with the SEC, who seem now to be competing with each other. How did we finally get to a global settlement? How did we move from the competition you were describing before to a place where, in the end, for $1.4 billion, I believe, the case was settled comprehensively?
I think we all, and by we I mean all the regulators, including Attorney General Spitzer, realized that this wasn't good for the market, that the competition maybe had been a good way to get started. We had divided up the work, but really to fairly resolve this, we needed to bring all that work together and come up with a unified response to this. As state regulators, we have been concerned for some time about further preemption. We'd seen an initiative by the Morgan Stanley to get a bill introduced to preempt us in early 2002. We were worried about vulnerability if we didn't come together with the SEC on a resolution. Attorney General Spitzer came to the conclusion that this needed to be unified. We ended up with settlement discussions with the states being represented by NASA primarily, and that's where my personal role came in. As NASA's president, I was our point person, but New York had its own seat at the table because of the role they had played in bringing these cases about, with the SEC, the New York Stock Exchange, and the NASD coming together and deciding we needed to have one way of resolving this, and we had to overcome some obstacles like, do we do restitution, do we do fines, how fast can we do this, how do we compare the apples and oranges of these investigations to come up with a way to figure out what fine a particular firm will pay, exactly what are the details of separating the structural issues, research banking, research and investment banking. We came up with this innovative idea of providing independent research, which will only go into effect next month in July of 2004. So that's yet to even play out and see how effective that's going to be.
And one of the tough issues that you had to face was once $1.4 billion was created with a combination of disgorgement, restitution, and fines, what was going to be done with the money? And that's something, I take it, the states didn't quite see eye to eye on.
Our tradition has been that once we make the resolution and come up with a settlement amount, it's up to each individual sovereign state to determine what they do with their penalty. Some will do restitution if they can. Some will fund various, you know, good efforts. Some will put it into the state treasury. We followed that model really in this global settlement by saying, okay, half of this is going to be the federal amount. You, the SEC, and the federal government, you can do whatever you want with it. And they made a determination to set up a restitution fund. The states looked at the restitution issue and said, we don't think this can be done in any meaningful way. We think it's going to be too hard to identify the investors. We won't be able to determine how much what their damages are. And we're not going to be able to get, even with this over $1 billion, it's not enough money really to make meaningful restitution. So we went with our traditional model, which was each state got a check and did what they wanted to do with it. In Maine, it went into our state treasury. Missouri, I think they contributed to the federal restitution fund. In another state, I believe it was Nebraska, they chaired a law school professor position. And it was just left up to each jurisdiction to make that determination.
To what extent do you think that gives us a model for the future? Do you think as whenever, and I guess the mutual fund scandal has provided us with the next round of cases, and certainly there's been a lot of state activism with respect to reaching settlements, seeking criminal prosecutions against various participants in the market timing and late trading debates. Would you say from now on the drill is going to be, if there is a substantial nationwide fraud, NASA and the states are going to step forward and say, we have a place at the table,
yep,
such that global settlements are going to become the norm, and that nobody's going to walk away from a big fraud without satisfying the state constituencies as well as the federal government? Is that now fixed? Is that our template for the future of securities law?
Yes and no. I think that has been the template for the last decade or so. I think the global settlement made us all realize, all regulators realize, that we needed to have some understanding about this. And it led to us forming what we call the initiative, the state SEC initiative, where we meet regularly with the enforcement folks at the SEC and talk about what kind of cases are you doing, what kind of cases are we doing, are we duplicating each other's effort, is there a good public policy reason for duplicating each other's effort, can we divide up the labor, can we leverage each other's resources. I think if you're looking at a big fraud, a big market-wide case that involves fraud that can be traced to having some effect on individual retail investors, yes, you can bet the states will be right there saying, we regulate the securities markets in our states, and we have a right to have a say about how this matter gets resolved. At the same time, I think there's a willingness on the SEC's part to sort of to work with us and to recognize that role and to try to come up with some common response so that we're not working against each other. We're not eliminating competition here. It's not a perfect system. We barely had time to catch our breath between the research analysts and the mutual fund. We haven't worked through all the issues, but I think there's a willingness on both sides to keep whittling away at it and to try and find the right answer.
You mentioned before efforts to preempt the states, and obviously that was one of the big stories this mm-hmm. past year in the aftermath of the global settlement, concern that states really shouldn't have this role in setting policy as to what good and bad behavior is and what the consequences should be of misbehavior. And certainly the cooperative effort, the task force, is an effort to show everyone that this is not a dangerous out-of-hand system, but rather a coordinated exercise in cooperative federalism, to use the phrase. Are you confident that this is going to answer the critics who have said the states may have a role in protecting retail investors, but when it comes to things like policies and procedures at nationwide or worldwide securities firms, they ought to step back?
I think we demonstrated in these cases the value of that complementary state and federal system, the fact that the states are the early warning system. We are closest to the investors. We were able to spot a problem early on and bring attention to it. We do act as a counterbalance to the SEC's perspectives on how different regulatory matters ought to be settled. I think, if anything, we made the case for state securities regulation. I think it's a robust system. I think we ought to put the money and resources into making sure all the regulators have what they need to do their jobs well. And I hope that we've demonstrated it's a healthy system that ought to be continued for another 100 years.
And with that, we're going to have to stop. Thanks, Chris, for
Thank you, Don.
Our discussion. Just a reminder, today's chat is now archived in the Society's Virtual Museum, so you can listen again to this discussion. Transcript of today's chat will soon be placed in the museum. Next time, our fireside chat will focus on forensic accounting. Our guests will be James Barrett and Ernest Teneich of FTI Consulting, Inc. The chat will be sponsored by FTI. Join us Tuesday, September 21st at 2 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. Thanks for being with us today.